It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. That's audiblepodcast.com/majority report for a free audiobook.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 15th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, on the, well, at least a couple billion dollars worth of losses by J.P. Morgan. Matt Taibbi, also on the program, giving us a little preview of the protests we anticipate in Chicago in the upcoming week. Jeff Smith. And on today's program, Rebecca Brooks. Pervert! She's a pervert. The Brits have said it now. She's a pervert. She perverted justice and has been charged with others. Global warming, apparently still happening. That's still happening. Americans elect, not so much. That is not happening. However, what is happening is they still have ballot access. We will discuss that more in the program. Student loans, still a problem. MEK, the terrorist group from Iran, or I should say Iraq, maybe not a terrorist group anymore. We will discuss. But first, this poll, which was sent to me by one of our listeners, and it's an interesting poll, more interesting in the way that it's being framed by Gallup. Despite the recent political emphasis on wealth inequality and the call for higher taxes on the rich, more than 6 in 10 Americans think the United States benefits from having a class of rich people, unchanged from 22 years ago. Well, there's a couple of things. Before I even look at what the poll says, there's a couple of things that occur to me. One is, 22 years ago was 1990, where we had just basically come out of the decade of greed. So that's not terribly surprising. I'd be far more interested in what this poll would have said 40, 50 years ago. But even then, that's irrelevant. Is it any surprise to anyone that the American public has no problem with a class of rich people? Does anybody even think that the people on Occupy Wall Street have a problem with a class of rich people in the main? Of course not. The issue is not that people should not be rich. The issue is that there shouldn't be such an inordinate amount of wealth inequality. We've had rich people before in this country, but we've only had this measure of inequality back in the 1920s. And not only is there a problem with this type of great inequality, the real problem is that it has now made it impossible for our government to function properly. The problem isn't that we have a plutonomy. The problem is that we have a plutocracy, that the wealthy now have distorted our democracy in such a fashion that our representative leaders not just don't generally make decisions on what's best for the vast majority of Americans. It's that it's a regular feature now. And we've seen this proof out of numerous studies, particularly that one out of Princeton, which shows that over the past 30 years, regardless of what the party in power is, when you have any type of controversial issues, they are resolved based upon the preferences of the rich. So the idea that 63% of Americans say that having a class of rich people benefits America is in no way surprising. In fact, I'm surprised it's not larger than that. And I guess it wasn't 20 years ago. And then the Gallup sort of breathlessly, not only do a majority of Americans believe having a class of rich people is a good thing, but the majority of Americans who do not consider themselves rich now would like to be rich if they had their choice. Really? Is that supposed to be shocking in any way? What's shocking is that only says 63%. I mean, now, I imagine if you say, like, what would it take to be rich, you might have a different number. But if someone's going to drop off, I want to make this absolutely clear. If anybody wants to drop off a package at our office with several million dollars, or it can be cash or it can be a check, I don't care. I'll take it. It's just sort of a dumb question. I'm frankly surprised. What is interesting, though, the only thing interesting in this poll, and it's sort of buried into it, is that people who think that it is not very likely or not likely at all that they will be rich, that's crept up just a bit, about 5%. This is, of course, from 1990. So, I don't know. This poll, it got sent to me, and there was sort of, I don't know if there was an implication like, whoa, this is sort of surprising. No, it isn't at all. The problem isn't that we have rich people in this country. The problem is that we have such wealth disparity. And the problem is that that distorts our democracy. And you can see it whether it's on a regulatory front, whether it's on the type of politicians we get front, it throughout the system, it distorts it. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Matt Taibbi about his good friend, Jamie Dimon. I don't know if they're really good friends. We'll see. This episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by Audible.com. It's the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. You heard her on this program the other day. Liz Winstead's Liz Free or Die is on Audible now as we speak, and you can get a free download of it. audiblepodcast.com/majority report. Go to audiblepodcast.com/majority report. We'll have the link on majority.fm, and you can get a free audiobook right now. Get that Liz Winstead book. Don't be silly. Do it. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Rolling Stone writer, author of Griftopia, Matt Taibbi. Welcome to the program, Matt.
What's up, Sam?
Let me ask you a question. I mean, I actually have like one person in mind. I haven't known that many crack addicts, but but I've known a couple, and the one in particular I'm thinking about, I had more restraint than it seems that these brokers do.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. It's amazing that they, you know, there have been so many cautionary tales about what kind of trades you can't get into, but these guys always seem to want to push the edge of the envelope. They have that excess macho gene, all of them. They're all extremely confident, and they just, from what I understand of this particular trade, the Chase thing, they really didn't think it was a dangerous trade. They were so sure this was going to pan out that they're just surprised that it's blowing up.
Well, of course. I mean, that's the point. I mean, if, you know, I can't imagine really that there was a lot of people in these banks, these investment banks or banks, I guess. And that's sort of the problem. We just call them banks that was engaged in this stuff in the middle of this decade, who were thinking like, I'm not so sure. I mean, you know, they all think they're going to make money, but the other problem is that they're backstopped by the United States government in many respects.
Right.
And it adds to the confidence. But walk us through what happened here, just so that people, we get a notion of this, so that we can talk about its implications for regulation.
Well, basically, first people need to understand what the concept of proprietary trading is. Prop trading just means a bank trading for its own account. So normally an investment banker is somebody who takes an order for a client. You know, typically like a pension fund will call up Goldman Sachs and say, we want to buy $100 million of this or $200 million of that. The investment bank places the order for the client. Proprietary trading is different. Proprietary trading is the bank itself saying, we want to bet on, you know, commodities or corporate bonds or mortgages. And that's what this was. This was a proprietary trade. And apparently what happened was the biggest and weightiest of the traders on their London desk decided to get extremely long on corporate debt. And he was making something that's called a basis trade that's extremely complicated. But he really thought that that corporate debt was a good bet earlier this year. Word leaked out of the bet, and apparently what happened is the rest of the market knew they had this huge position. They rallied up to the other side of it and kind of basically beat the guy's brains in and caused this huge collapse, and that's where they are.
Now, going long on corporate debt means essentially that you're betting down the road that the corporate debt, the bonds, the people loan this money to corporations, that it's going to be worth more than it is now. And so
it's a little more complicated than that. They were betting on an index that there was an index that was set up that tracks credit default swaps against corporate debt. It's sort of like an insurance policy that, you know what CDS are. It's sort of like a non-insurance insurance product to guarantee corporate debt. They just decided to invest heavily in that sort of CDS. They were essentially selling credit protection on corporate bonds, which meant that they thought that corporate debt was going to become more valuable, as you said.
And they're also arguing that this was a hedge. In other words, that it that they had exposure sort of in the opposite direction, and this was a hedge. They were basically covering their losses on another side. So in their eyes, this was actually sort of a function of a certain risk averseness, I guess.
Well, right. There's a couple of things here. First of all, this particular department, typically what they do, banks in general with their investments, they tend to be long on things because they're lending out money, they're investing in businesses, and so the overall tendency of a bank like J.P. Morgan Chase is to be long on the economy, long on corporations. So typically what a unit like this will do is they'll go the other direction. They'll be shorting because they want to hedge the bank's exposure to all these various markets. What's interesting about this is that exactly the opposite happened here. This unit went long instead of short. I don't see how what they did could have been hedging. It hasn't been properly explained to me how that could be the case. But if it was hedging, then that's important because that would have been legal under the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule, which bans certain kinds of proprietary trading, made exceptions for hedging. So if this was a hedge, theoretically, it was okay under the law.
And we should say that the Volcker Rule is not fully settled yet, is it? I mean, they're still sort of developing it, but that's the broader outlines of the rule and how it actually gets implemented. And I guess what would be considered a hedge probably is also something that they're attempting to develop right now.
Right. And again, if we can go big picture for a minute here. This is what the critics of the Volcker Rule and Dodd-Frank are always talking about, that it's impossible to implement this rule because it's 10 million pages long, and you know, what's a hedge, what's risky proprietary trading, you have to codify all this, and you need a team of lawyers just to figure out what's a proper trade and what isn't a proper trade. Well, the reason we have to have all these complicated rules is because the Wall Street and the Republicans and some Democrats who were on board with or against reform didn't allow us to do the simple thing, which is just reinstall Glass-Steagall, which simply separated investment banks, commercial banks, and insurance companies. If we had done that, we wouldn't need a Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule is basically a watered-down version of that.
But it's not a watered-down version. I mean, that is exactly the point. And, you know, I had this conversation with Alexis Goldstein, I think her name is. She was she did the Occupy SEC. And that was one of the critiques of that is that the problem is that it's not simply a watered-down version of Glass-Steagall. What it is a fundamentally different animal by category, because Glass-Steagall would have just put up a firewall, as you say, separated these separate entities so that if somebody's going to do a proprietary trade, they're not going to do it with the notion with the notion that the government is insuring their losses, because it's deposits. It is the depositors. Grandma has put her money in the bank. And the banker's going out and gambling, taking that money, and instead of loaning it out in sort of these conservative loans in the community or however broadly you want to define that, they're going out and going to the casino with it. And then the government gets held holding the bag. What do you think the chances are? I mean, we're hearing people like starting to talk now. I mean, this is the first time I've heard, sort of the words Glass-Steagall come up. And we should say, when we're talking about the real point here is that $2 billion, I've got a piece somewhere in my pile from somebody from Reason Magazine saying, like, look, there's no problem here because, this loss can easily be absorbed by J.P. Morgan. They're a big company. The government's not costing the government any money. We don't even know if the regulation would have worked against it. But the real problem here is that, A, we don't even know if it's just $2 billion. And B, next time, there's nothing to stop it from being $200 billion.
Right, right. Look, this what happened here is extremely similar to what happened with AIG. In AIG, you had a big conservative, relatively conservative insurance company that had a small rogue unit, AIG Financial Products, that coincidentally was also based in London, and they were essentially doing the same thing that this unit was doing. They were going long, they were selling credit protection, and they made a gigantic bet. It was much bigger than this bet, but they made a gigantic bet on mortgages. And it turned into a nuclear-powered sort of chain of losses for the company. And that's the risk here with something like J.P. Morgan Chase, is that especially with derivatives and the interconnectedness of all these different departments and even in the interconnectedness of all these different banks, when one unit suffers a huge loss, it can trigger all sorts of unintended consequences. And if a company that big gets into trouble or goes out of business, the FDIC is not adequate to bail out J.P. Morgan Chase. It will eventually come out of your pocket and my pocket, and it will have a catastrophic effect on the entire economy. So, yeah, it's only $2 billion, but who knows how much it will eventually be, and who knows how bad it will be the next time. That's
right.
The problem.
This is $2 billion 3 or 4 years out from the most catastrophic financial meltdown we've had by the supposed most conservative, safe better on Wall Street, essentially.
Right, right. And again, people don't understand. I think people misunderstand what the criticism is about this activity. Nobody cares if an investment bank or a hedge fund wants to make, a crazy, reckless cowboy gamble on whatever, corporate debt, mortgages. If they want to do that, mazel tov. That's what those guys do, and some of them make a lot of money, and I guess it creates quote-unquote liquidity for the market. It creates capital for all of us to play with. But the problem is that it's not just a hedge fund. It's not just an investment bank. This is a depository institution that gets free money from the Federal Reserve. They've gotten $390 billion in emergency lending from the Fed in the last 4 years. And they are sitting atop of, I think, 10% of America's banking deposits. So they're playing not only with money from the Fed, but with the money they have from ordinary people, firemen, teachers, everybody who has their money in Chase. That money is being bet because some crazy lunatic in London thinks the corporate debt's going to go up in the next couple of months. And that's what we can't have. We can't have federally insured depository institutions doing this.
And this bank, we should say, is significantly larger than it was in 2008. I mean, this is, so the too big to fails are bigger than they actually were in 2008 when we needed to come in and bail them out.
And we made them larger. Let's not forget that Chase is bigger now because it's not just Chase, they're Bear Stearns, and we helped them with $30 billion in guarantees from the Federal Reserve. We helped them buy the corpse of Bear Stearns, and then they also bought up Washington Mutual with the aid of a $25 billion bailout in the summer of 2008. A lot of people think, actually, if you might have been following the news lately, that some of Chase's competitors, including Citigroup and Bank of America and Morgan Stanley, they've recently been downgraded, and so their debt is trading just a couple of levels above junk now. There's a lot of fear on Wall Street that some of these other too-big-to-fail companies are going to collapse, and what's the only playbook we have for dealing with that is to merge them into a bigger company like Chase. And so we might end up with a situation a couple of years from now where it's like Coke and Pepsi, where we have Chase and Wells Fargo, and those are the only banks left on Wall Street. And so that's the real concern here.
And maybe one day we can just get to where we just call them America.
It's just one company, one bank,
and we just call it America. Not even right. Forget the word bank in front of it. So now I have to ask this question. I already know the answer. Is this going to reopen anything, or is it just going to be a lot of jawboning? And because I'm very cynical about the capacity for the Volcker Rule to really impact this problem significantly. Just from everything I've read, I mean, of course, I'm not incredibly sophisticated about these things, but from what I've read from different voices, my sense is that once you get these rules in place, there's just other vehicles, instruments that are developed to sort of go around these rules, and the party continues.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. They did create the Volcker Rule, and a lot of these companies did reduce the size of their prop trading operations. But the Volcker Rule has been delayed until 2014. It was supposed to be completed and implemented by next month, but they didn't finish writing the rules on time. So now we have another extension to finish their homework. And the history of Dodd-Frank suggests that whenever there's an extension or whenever things are delayed, the lobbyists and the lawyers on the other side get together and they find some way to punch a new hole in the rule. They either sue or they create new legislation or, you know, who knows what it will be. I'm right with you. I have absolutely no doubt that this will never result in, you know, a tougher Volcker Rule. There might be some headlines in the next couple of weeks, but 2 years down the road, we're going to be right back where we started.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, it really is sort of amazing. And I noticed the first thing that Jamie Dimon did is sort of, well, after getting a second bite at the apple on Meet the Press, which I thought was just sort of stunning, just, you know, because I get the idea of, well, you want an updated interview, but how awesome would it have been to run the first interview and then have him back on right after that one completed and say, hey, you know, that was just 3 days ago.
Right.
You had a very different tone about you at the time. But you know, he went out there and he was like, well, I think there could be some regulators should take a look at this. Because, of course, you know, all he wants is it to be a rogue trader who deserves some punishment and so that there is no further regulation in preventing them to engage in this type of behavior on our dime.
Yeah, I mean, he obviously was taking a much haughtier tone about the Volcker Rule a couple of months ago. He's going to act contrite now, but again, the entire experience of this bank in recent years is that they ultimately get away with everything, no matter what they do. They were implicated in a sweeping scandal to rig municipal bonds, the bidding process for municipal bonds all across the country. They paid a slap on the wrist fine for that, and that was a gigantic felony that they got away with. They were involved in that awful case in Jefferson County, Alabama, where their Chase executives were caught bribing local officials to take toxic swap deals. They got off on that one, and they're going to get away with this one too. Dimon knows that he's going to have to act sorry a little bit in public for the next couple of weeks, but then they can go right back to business as usual after that.
That's the amazing thing about it is, like, I'm gonna have to bite the bullet and give four interviews that show that I have contrition. This is gonna be a really hard couple of weeks for me. I'm gonna need a couple extra stiff ones when I go home and then go out for my $1,000 dinners. Talk to us. Just explain to people what he's doing on the New York on the New York Fed board and what the implications of that are.
Well, it's not terribly unusual for somebody like Jamie Dimon to be on the board of the Federal Reserve. The Fed branches are sort of quasi-private organizations that are essentially run. They're administered by the member banks. But the disturbing thing about Jamie Dimon being on the board of the New York Fed is that he's been in a position to essentially give himself a bailout over and over and over again. Dimon was on the board of the New York Fed back in March of 2008 when Bear Stearns collapsed, and the Fed negotiated a sale price for Bear Stearns of $2 a share, which was about 20 times less than what the market thought it was at the moment. He helped them get that $30 billion guarantee to buy Bear Stearns well below market prices. He helped execute the bailout for that allowed him to buy Washington Mutual. And he's been on the board this whole time while they've been receiving emergency lending from the Fed. So it seems to me it's an enormous conflict of interest. I don't know how anybody sees it any other way, but that's the way we do things. And it's just it's not going to change unless somebody does something about it.
Is there a chance that there is some other industry out there, some other industry group, some other rich people who might just say, hey, you know what? This is problematic, you know, like this is like now endangering my bottom line, but, you know, I'm trying to imagine who those people would be, but they're, you know, they enjoy the largesse almost in many respects as much as Wall Street does, at least in terms of the way that, that wealth inequality has sort of fundamentally misaligned the incentives of our politicians in some respects. But I just wonder if there isn't, you know, some, and maybe we just don't have those people anymore, some big, wealthy manufacturers who just go, hey, wait a second, holy, I'm going to flex my muscle to try and force a Glass-Steagall.
Well, I think small regional banks or smaller regional banks are increasingly there's increasingly a polarization in the banking industry where there's a difference of opinion between these two big to fail banks and the smaller regional banks about policy. And the reason for that is really simple. It's when we allow too big to fail and we allow these companies like Chase to operate the way that they do, they have an inherent competitive advantage over smaller banks because their cost of borrowing is so much cheaper. Everybody knows that Chase is never going to go out of business, so they don't charge as much to lend to Chase or to Goldman Sachs or to Citigroup. They'll charge a lot more to lend to a smaller regional bank. And so these banks have a direct personal interest in breaking up too big to fail. And I think you started to see some momentum toward that on the peripheries lately. We had the Dallas Fed come out with a paper arguing for the breakup of these companies. There's a bill that's been reintroduced in the Senate to break up these companies. And you're hearing more traditionally conservative people talk about that because this isn't capitalism. This is the opposite of capitalism. It's a state subsidy system. And it offends a lot of traditional conservatives and capitalists, and I think you're going to start seeing more of that kind of opposition.
Right. All right. Let me just turn to one other. I mean, that'll be interesting to see if we get that because every time I hear one of those self-ID'd paleo conservatives. Libertarians say, this is not capitalism. It's just bailing out the banks. Invariably, it just seems to me that they spend far more time on loan guarantees for a small
right.
solar company before
right.
they talk about the trillions of dollars that we're giving these banks. But I guess hope springs eternal. Well, and speaking of hoping springing eternal, the House, and I don't know if they'll get away with this, but voted the other day to cut the funding for the Financial Fraud Task Force to keep it from getting paid, which is it's just unbelievable. I don't know how anybody can vote for something to cut the enforcement mechanism to find fraud. You know, I mean, it's just sort of like, but they did it. What is your sense of what's going on with Schneiderman? He was on Chris Hayes' show, up with Chris, last week it was now. Sort of hemming and hawing, like, oh, no, things are moving, and we got phones now, and soon, you know. Have you heard anything as you sort of dig around in your reporting? As to what's going on with that whole thing?
Well, I did right after they created that task force. I got a bunch of calls from people who in the commodities world who said, "Hey, if you want to know what's going to happen with that task force, go and look what happened to Obama's oil and gas task force, which he created last year. We had a spike in oil prices that was caused by speculation in the commodities markets, and Obama decided to create a task force, and he put Eric Holder in charge of creating that task force. And a year later, when we had another spike, he decided to call on that task force again, but he had to reassemble the task force because they hadn't done anything in the course of that year. They'd only met a couple of times. So the reality is nobody thinks that these task forces are really going to do anything. They're essentially blue ribbon committees that look good in a headline. But Obama didn't need an oil and gas task force. All he had to do was call up the CFTC and order them to comply with the Dodd-Frank regulations against speculation in those markets. And he didn't need a mortgage task force either. All he had to do was call up Eric Holder and tell him to start bringing cases against mortgage fraud. I mean, I can walk into any courthouse in this country and look at any foreclosure case and find robo-signed signatures in any document in this country. And so it's not hard to find these cases. They're not bringing them. So yeah, they're cutting the funding for this task force, but the task force I just didn't think was going to be anything real anyway.
So what's Schneiderman doing here? I mean, is Schneiderman for real, or was he hoodwinked?
Well, I always thought so. He has a great reputation. Everybody thinks he is for real, but everybody thinks that I talked to that this was getting that task force was his price for signing off on the robo-signing settlement, that all the banks were involved with, this so-called global settlement. And because he was one of the last holdouts in that settlement, and then suddenly he gets his task force and he's willing to go along with it. I don't want to think that that's true, but that's kind of what the optics look like.
The less cynical version, which is still sort of sad, is that he thought that he was going to have access to more tools to bring cases against these people with federal help. And so that was the deal he made. And basically he got played. He shows up there and he finds out, okay, well, I'll chalk this up to this is a good learning lesson.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, that's possibilities. Yeah, that's very much possible as well. I mean,
it's I guess it's no, it doesn't, it's no, it doesn't make me any happier to think that way. But that's sort of
right.
The best case scenario is just that this guy whose heart was in the right place got completely outplayed in that situation, because certainly when he signed on to that, he was not shy about saying, judge me and this task force by what we're doing, 18 weeks out from now, 16 weeks out from now. Well, that time has passed, and so far it's just, we got the phone system set up, and that's about
it. Right, right. And again, it's not like finding a needle in the haystack. Any lawyer who's been involved with the foreclosure cases or dozens and dozens of lawsuits that he could
are those robo signing? I mean, in the mortgage fraud deal, essentially, that forget about the fact that there was virtually seemingly no punishment. What exactly did they get in the clear from? I mean, those robo signed documents, are those now kosher or what?
Well, no, the deal didn't cover any criminal activity. That deal was entirely about civil litigation. So there's no reason why Eric Schneiderman couldn't go in and bring up bring a case against these banks for having robo-signing departments, which they all do. I mean, again, all he has to do is walk into one of these buildings, find the department where guys are signing stacks and stacks of affidavits, and just put handcuffs on all of them. They're all breaking the law. They're all committing fraud. It's right out in the open. It's kind of like that scene in The Untouchables where, Sean Connery's like, everybody knows where the liquor is. It's just we haven't gone in there yet. And that's That's kind of what's going on with these banks. They're all doing this illegal activity. And then that's not even the worst part of it. I mean, the worst part of it was really more the securities fraud aspect of it, where they were representing bad mortgages as good mortgages. And there are dozens of those cases they could bring as well. They're just
right, and that's not that none of that stuff was even included in the context of the settlement. I mean, that wasn't even referenced whatsoever. It was a far more narrow. And what you're talking, the second part you're talking about, it seems to me there's plenty of evidence in that Senate report that Carl Levin did that outlines all of it. Not to mention that they probably also lied to the Senate in the course of those hearings.
Oh yeah, no. There are so many of these lawsuits involving investors who bought mortgage-backed securities, institutional investors and pension funds and retirement funds that bought into these mortgage-backed securities. They were told by banks like Bank of America that they were of high quality, that due diligence had been performed, and they just lied about that. And it's not difficult to prove. And a lot of these cases have already been settled precisely because it isn't difficult to prove. They have such a good case that a lot of these things haven't even gotten to court yet. So Schneiderman, if he wanted to, he could go wild on the whole industry. I mean, he could take any one of the banks, because they are all equally guilty, into court. And there's a whole range of criminal penalties he could apply.
Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone magazine, always horribly depressing to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Sam.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate you coming on.
All right.
All right. Folks, we're going to take a we're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to be talking to Jeff Smith, who's going to give us a heads up about what's going to take place in Chicago. Already, my understanding is they've already protested in front of Obama's office. Campaign office in Chicago. We'll hear more from Jeff, and I think he has a little request of you as well. We'll be right back after this.
Look through the window. I'm looking through a pane of glass. Look through the window, and what do you see? Look through the window, and what do you see? Look through the window.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Jeff Smith, Occupy Wall Street media team, writing for the Daily Beast. Is that right?
Yep, that's right.
God knows what else this guy is up to. But in the near term, my understanding is we're anticipating some action in Chicago.
Yeah, the NATO protests that'll be next Sunday in Money, the 20 and 21st, has spurred basically an entire almost month of action, really starting at the beginning of May. But originally there were going to be the G8 protests there as well, so they got scared off, but it didn't really stop Occupy from filling up the calendar. So there's an entire counter summit that's happening on the Friday and Saturday preceding NATO, and John Nichols and I think Tom Hayden are there, and they'll be speaking, and there'll be teach-ins and all sorts of activities going on there. But there are other more specifically Occupy-type protests that are going to happen. One in particular that's pretty interesting on Saturday, and this is protesting in particular the issue of mental health and the clinics that Rahm Emanuel has shut down in Chicago. The Occupy and other protesters are going to go to Rahm Emanuel's neighborhood and actually go door to door and ask his neighbors where they think they should get their mental health services. And they'll have, in fact, some patients, mental health patients themselves will be asking, and people in gowns, and it should be quite a scene. But we're going to take it to Mayor Emanuel's neighborhood, so that should be quite exciting. And then on Monday, there's a quite a big action to target and shut down Boeing. Boeing, among many terrible companies that we have in this country, was relocated its headquarters in 2001 to Chicago, and in the process got all sorts of lucrative tax breaks that robbed the city of, you know, huge amounts of money. And there seems to be certainly a big focus in, of the counter protest that is around healthcare and just the idea of juxtaposing NATO and the, you know, warfare industry with, you know, the issue of healthcare in this country, which is frankly obscene to think about the amount of money that we spend, you know, of our tax money on warfare, hurting, maiming, and killing people. In fact, so many people in this country can't even get access to first world healthcare.
Yeah, and now it's interesting because you mentioned this up front, but the G8 was supposed to be there, and they ended up moving that to Camp David because there was a lot of these protests were centered around the austerity measures that are being imposed around the world, in addition, and certainly in a lot of these G8 countries. And so is there going to be, I mean, it's interesting. What is directly the protest about NATO going to be? I mean, is it going to be, are they, what do you have a sense of what the main beef with NATO is?
Well, I mean, I think to a certain extent, a lot of the, you know, the drone warfare, the sort of covert warfare that goes on, I think is linked with NATO, and certainly the Libya excursion that we had was, you know, put under right. the banner of NATO, and I think that was in a lot of ways as, you know, criminal of a war as we've seen in this country, and so, you know, I imagine that will be a big part of it. But really, it's about connecting just the, you know, essentially the warfare industry. I mean, why does NATO even exist anymore at this point? You know, this was something that was created in the context of, you know, world wars, and now it just seems like a country club of sorts, mm-hmm. where, you know, big business interests and, you know, arms manufacturers, et cetera, come and congregate and figure out which, you know, sort of conflict, named or not, that they're going to, you know, extract their toll on.
And I know, I think it's on May 20th, there's going to be Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans are going to be marching. And basically for that, it's a coalition against NATO and G8 war and poverty agenda. And I guess there are going to be vets who are going to be handing over their service medals to military NATO generals to basically say, you know, too much money being spent on war, not enough on helping people, which is always a good thing. Well, I mean, this is going to be pretty exciting, and it's also going to be interesting to see, because I have a sense that Chicago is going to be a bit of a training ground in some respects for the protests that we're bound to see in North Carolina and in Florida during the conventions. And so it'll be interesting to see what kind of tactics are being used to sort of quell the protest, essentially, by the Chicago police.
For sure. I mean, I think it presents, you know, for me and for a lot of people that are traveling in from out of town, a very different kind of scenario. I mean, when you face arrest, really, for any kind of a reason out of state, it becomes a real hassle going back and forth to make all your court dates. I mean, the arrest that I faced back in December, I'm still heading back and forth to court over 6 months later. So it really is a factor, and certainly something that they'll probably use to try and intimidate and deter people. But, you know, I certainly wouldn't put it past Rahm Emanuel to pull out all the stops.
Right. All right. And speaking of you going to Chicago, you're going to be filing some reports with us. Hopefully we'll be talking to you on Monday, assuming you're not in the clink. But you need some help getting out there. Is that correct?
That is true, Sam. You know, like a lot of journalists these days, it sort of has to be funded by the public. And, you know, I think what we saw on May Day was that without a lot of the independent journalists out there, it's almost as if you wouldn't have gotten the real story.
Absolutely.
And so I think this, for this protest, it's really important to have as many people, you know, with boots on the ground actually reporting what's going on and countering any, you know, narrative that's created, you know, back in the newsrooms by the major media.
Absolutely. And people were very supportive of me when I headed out to Wisconsin. And, you know, when I have a situation where I'm traveling for something, I sometimes I try and work out a deal with Ring of Fire, who have a little deeper pockets than I do, and we get there. We're certainly going to do that with Netroots. How can people, if they want to donate, and you're going to have where is your donate page to get out there?
It's set up on WePay, so it's wepay.com/donations/. There's a link that you put on your page.
Yes.
And if people go to my Twitter page as well, there's a link right on my profile. They can find it there also.
And your Twitter profile, Don't Be a Putz.
Of course.
Right. I mean, who would want to be a putz?
That's
but
right.
Some people are. But we'll also put a link at majority.fm. Folks, if you can help out, $5, $10, it will help you get more information about what's going on in Chicago. I'll tell you something. I was really shocked by what happened on May Day in this city. You know, we're in New York. You know, this is not like if I'm working, let's say, at 30 Rockefeller Center and I'm on a liberal cable station, that it would be that hard for me to send a producer down there and realize, like, wow, there's 30,000 people marching in the city. That's pretty dramatic, particularly since the police have done everything they can in this city to discourage people from coming out. That's pretty dramatic. We didn't see that type of coverage. We saw virtually no coverage. I remember when that Reuters guy came out, Occupy Wall Street, a dud, because the guy left at like 12:30 and had seemingly no idea what was going on. It makes it very important for us to have people there. And then it's a great opportunity for me personally, or for at least for this show, to have you out there to get access to firsthand account of what's going on. So I can't encourage people enough to majority.fm. We'll have a link to Jeff's WePay, or you can go on Twitter and just go to his handle, Don't Be a Putz, and you'll get a link there. $5, $10, $25, whatever you got, $1. Anything will help, and it will defray at least some of your costs going out there. And gosh, who knows? Bail will be covered by somebody else, I presume.
It will, but there are quite a number of people coming from New York to this protest, and I think that it will be definitely interesting to see, because normally around NATO, there's always been somewhat of a protest movement, and so it'll be interesting to see if Occupy Wall Street energizes it to the extent that we actually start to hear about it once in a while.
Right.
You know, I mean, anti-war protests are about the last thing that I think most major media ever want to cover, and it's a shame, because we're now in a state of perpetual war, and the fact that it's basically absent from all of our news coverage is really a shame. So,
well, what I'm looking for is protests that aren't simply anti-war, but are actually suggesting what we should do with that money. And that's, I think, the slight difference here is that, you know, certainly when I was, you know, when we were out protesting the Iraq invasion and occupation in the early aughts, it was simply to stop a war. And now it is really just sort of, I think there is more of a sense of people should understand that not only that wars come at all, with all sorts of costs, and hopefully this is a leverage point where, you know, sometimes it's hard to get the broader public sort of to care about people who are thousands of miles away. Hopefully they'll perhaps maybe tune into it a little bit more when they understand the implications of what it means to their everyday life, despite the fact that our leaders have done everything they can to insulate us from the costs of war by making it sort of a remote video game in some respects. But so good luck out there, Jeff, and we'll be in touch, and hopefully we'll talk to you on Monday.
Great. Thanks a lot, Sam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Again, head over to majority.fm. We've got a link to Jeff's WePay account, and you can help support independent media, independent reporting in this instance. And, of course, as always, we encourage you to become a member to further that support. We have merch. You can use our Amazon link to buy your Amazon crap, assuming you buy any crap from Amazon. JustCoffee.coop, 10% discount. You didn't hear it yesterday, but Jeremo called up. Was it Jeremo? I think Jeremo called up. I've never heard anybody so excited about coffee in my entire life. He loves it. It's great coffee. JustCoffee.coop, 10% coupon code. Use the coupon code majority. Have you given us an iTunes review yet? Don't know why you haven't if you haven't. Donate your account. DonateYourAccount.com/majorityFM. Donate your Twitter or your Facebook postings just to get the word out. You will never feel embarrassed by what we have posted. We don't do spam. We don't do anything other than sort of like quality stories that make you seem, frankly, a little bit smarter with your friends. Or at least a little bit more engaged. All right, folks. Going to head to the better half of the program. Americans elect. New, sir. FDA punts again on sunscreen. 1,600 Palestinians end their hunger strike. All that and more in just a moment. Be right back.